You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So I'll better do a little introduction to this podcast. So I'm here with Jim Herrington, and usually I do this podcast. The last two, I've been walking through the streets of in some unidentified Arab city. So now we're in Krakow in Poland, and we're in the back room of probably the coolest. Probably if you lived in this room, you think you were living in absolute squalor, but. If you're a hipster, this is amazing.
It took a lot of money to look this. What is Dolly Parton's line? It takes a lot of money to look this trashy.
and I'm here with one of the coolest climbers, coolest human beings I've ever met, really, Jim Herrington. And as you can tell, I've put on my cool kind of like, hi, welcome to the Jazz Hour here. I've lost my voice from talking too much at other people. So,
I think there's a voice losing bug going around. There's three other people that lost their ability to talk.
Not a good thing to have at a festival.
Not so. The ones I would have chosen.
No, better than AIDS, something, or gonorrhea or something. You know. Anyway, I'll just cut that bit out later on because you don't want to be. We don't
no,
be inappropriate.
Don't
be inappropriate in this.
Yes,
you know.
We do.
So we have no questions written down, so it's that kind of thing.
No.
So I thought maybe we should start with something that always sticks in my mind is when I think I probably met you before, because we both won an award on the same night in Banff, and then we met at Kendall, and you came in on your Harley Davidson, you know.
I would never have a Harley Davidson.
No, you'd have some kind of...
I'd have a Triumph. Second, 660.
Yeah, Second World War kind of...
Triumph.
You know, you're almost like a Patrick Swayze kind of Roadhouse kind of... I know you've not seen Roadhouse, so have you?
I saw it just long enough to see my friend John Doe's acting extravagant.
I'll have to rewatch it, really. Someone told me that they always try to get, you know, like With Neil and I, it's like a really famous film that every single line in it is quotable, so people can, like, you know, repeat, a bit like Monty Python, people can repeat every single line from every Monty Python program ever. And someone told me that whenever they had meetings, they always tried to put in one line from Roadhouse, sneak into the meeting. So only the other people would realise this, but, you know, the manager wouldn't realise. And the only one line they never managed to get into the film was, I used to fuck people like you in prison.
Yes, I've known that line.
I remember we did this interview, I was interviewing you, and we were talking about all sorts of stuff. And I remember asking you about your pathway into the creative, you know, you're like a, you know, brilliant photographer, and your pathway into that. And you told us I'll get you to tell the story in a minute. But afterwards, I think we said, is anybody here in the creative industries? And there was these two guys with their hands up. And they were both doing media studies at university. I think they were in like their third year. And at the end, they came up and they said, we learned more in this hour than we have at 2 years at university. So it was, I think it only cost them £5. So it was quite good value. So it was like a really crap version of one of those masterclass programs for £5. So maybe we'll start, if you know, we won't go, like, I think people should go and discover you for themselves. That you should definitely look up your books, even buy the book The Climbers, but you should go back. There's a lot of really good podcasts with Jim, you know, talking about your past and things. But I think we should start with just tell us that you're a young lad and you get this camera and you know that this sort of journey into photography. But just tell us about this, when you went from being an amateur photographer, you know, like a really keen photographer, where you became this, beyond that, to some kind of professional. How did that happen?
We're skipping the again, but
we're going to the... Because these people always begin with, they always start with, how did you start climbing? So I thought we'll avoid that and we'll just get that.
Yeah.
When did you become someone who was paid to take photographs?
I'm from North Carolina, from Charlotte, basically, a small town. But I do remember, I'll tell you, the first job I ever had, where I actually made greenbacks, was I knew this man, a friend of mine was a bag boy at a grocery store, and he was kind of my punk rock music, one of my best friends, Pete. And he worked as a bag boy, and he, you know, the punk rock buttons you would wear on your shirt back in those days. And he was bagging groceries one day, and he said this kind of very erect, good posture, seemed to be a gay man, kind of came up and pointed to his button and said, I can't remember who the button was, you know, the Buzzcocks or something. And so the guy, they became friends, and he started inviting him over. And then my friend Pete said, oh, you should come over, this guy's really interesting. And I started going over there. And then Pete stopped hanging out. And I became friends with this guy. And so, you know, I'm a teenager with a lot of ideas about the world that I want to see. And I feel very stifled in fuddy-duddy Charlotte. And this guy had lived in England already. He was there during the punk rock days. But he was also really into... what's your guy? Churchill. Expert on Churchill. All these kind of crazy different interests. Very well read. And, but he was also sort of, what a weird life. You know, he'd been in all these scenes in London, but now he's in Charlotte managing this strip mall. And in this appliance store that was opening up, having their little opening day on a Saturday, was Eileen Fulton, who was one of these soap opera stars, actresses in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and this is about 1980. And I don't know if you have this in England, but in America, opening up an appliance store is sort of a thing these sort of has-been celebrities do, you know, in the parking lot on opening day. So Eileen Fulton, kind of glamorous in pearls and a fur coat, but definitely kind of over the edge on her youthful days. Opens this pathetic appliance store in Charlotte, and I got hired. He paid me like $40 to go document. So that was my first kind of brush with celebrity, and I made $40.
Do you still have the image?
I have the image somewhere, but I actually even have the check pay stub.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Try and
you have a wall full of these amazing.
No, I would never display such stuff, but.
Is it like no one knows the first email I ever sent? Like, it's such an important thing it's like the baby step into the digital world, but no one really keeps it or knows what. No, even, you know, our first email accounts was some weird thing. Like, I think mine was like Tesco, you know, Andy Kirkpatrick at Tesco.net or something.
Mindspring.com, I think.
Yeah, it's like a whole.
I didn't even know how to walk up to a computer. You know, someone had to. push me towards the front of the thing, and here's the on button, and here's the...
Did you ever hear that story? Someone was saying, they rang up like a helpline, and they said, my computer's not working. And they said, well, they're trying to work out what was wrong with it. And they said, I think it's something wrong with the foot pedal. And they had the mouse on the floor.
It's like a sewing machine.
So,
but I don't know, to answer your question. So I guess getting out of North Carolina, I went to this, couldn't really afford a great art school. Like I wanted to go to New York or somewhere. But I went to a school in North Carolina that was a good technical school.
Was this, so how old were you?
You know, college age, right after high school.
Yeah.
What is that?
So this, instead of going to university in the US, you go to sort of college.
Well, this was college, university, yeah, whatever. Depends on what you're doing.
Yeah.
I wanted to go to a great photography school.
Yeah. Where would that be in the US?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I would have liked to, even the Art Center, and there's one in Chicago, one in Atlanta. There was the, what do they call it, in Pasadena, the really great one a lot of people came out of. Whatever, we couldn't afford that. But this technical school, Randolph Technical College, they had some people from Rochester, which is where Kodak was based.
Yeah.
So these were some of the scientists of, which is weird because that's totally the opposite sort of type of person I am.
Yeah.
Well, there's one side of me, but as far as my photography, I'm definitely more of a feel person.
Yeah.
But it was good to get that kind of, and I learned a lot from these guys, but I dropped out after a year and a half.
Yeah.
There's a lot of photochemistry and using densitometers and all these things that are completely useless now because everything's digital.
Yeah.
But I just had to get out of North Carolina, so I moved out west to California. And
but was that a good...
You're trying to answer your question in a simple way.
But you know, those, and it's almost like a Karate Kid kind of thing. You know, you have these scientists who are trying to teach you about emulsions, and you don't want to. You just want to have a. You want to go out and fight, in a way.
I was impatient. I love learning, and I do like science.
But you weren't a chemist. You want to be a.
Well, my father was a bit of a chemist in the textile biz. And I liked beakers, and I liked the rigid recipe, formality, and truth of chemistry. You know, it's true or false, kind of.
Right. Yeah, the way it's no the kills
there's
you. Or
there's no it? Your interpretation of chemistry.
Yeah, yeah.
And I liked that, but I was just so impatient to get out in the world. I wanted to get on the mast of it, you know, the front of a ship, and be Shackleton. I was ready
and
so impatient, and here I was right after high school again in a fucking classroom.
Do you remember any of the teachers?
Do
any of that, do any of them have like an impression on you
in any school or in this college?
In this college,
yeah. There was the one that I remember the most was sort of the most hard ass kind. He was really the guy from Rochester. He was the, you know, sort of a genius, yeah. Photochemistry genius.
Yeah,
I can't remember his name anymore, but just really hardcore, very brutal.
Because a lot of those people were working for the CIA and
no sense of humor.
You know, the you know a lot of these, you know, the U-2 spy planes and things, and you know, there were so much interesting photography stuff came from the CIA. They were funding. You know, you could take a photograph from, you know, 50 miles looking sideways, and because there was a really good interview with someone who, when the Zeebrugger film, Zeebrugger, you know, when it was brought over to the labs at the at Langley, directly in the still in the camera, and the CIA photography guys there, like usually everything was sent to Kodak from the CIA, but these were the guys in Langley, and they had to, you know, process it, and then they all watched it once, and then it was all put into a can and it was taken away. But I found that really interesting, the really technical side of photography is something we often forget. But the same, you know, like the rule of thirds and all these things, there is like a, you can only break these rules once you know what the rules are.
Well, that's what I tell. I mean, you know, that's sort of a cliche about anything, but it really is true. Because And the way I had to kind of see that in practice and really learn it was as I got older and you know, did a few things to where, you know, I guess enough that younger people came up asking me, I want to do this, I want to do photography, how do I do it? And my answers, I think, were always disappointing, which my answers were almost always something involving like a whole lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And dedication. And it wasn't sexy to them. You know, I don't know what they think.
It wasn't like an Instagram account, get a girlfriend who wears tights, just take loads of photographs.
I don't know what they were thinking, but like, and I would see them drop like flies and just, or, you know, practically eyes roll back in their head. It's like, you know, and it's so different now with digital. You can just, but you know, the hours I spent alone in the dark room,
yeah,
wanting to be a good printer and not going to parties and not hanging out with friends and being there from 8 at night till 6 in the morning, yeah, kind of blowing the rest of the day. So, you know, I would spend days and nights and years trying to get good.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to hear that.
So, you know, people like...
And also kind of learning, like you say, learning the rules so you can break them.
Yeah.
But you got to really know... You got to know the rule. You got to know why you're breaking them.
Yeah, yeah.
It's stupid to just be an anarchist for no reason.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah,
just chaos.
The music suddenly come into life here. See if I can hear it. Sounds like we've got a soundtrack now.
Hold on. Let's see if there's a speaker. Okay. We're just gonna have a soundtrack, is it?
A little soundtrack there. I think. Okay.
They play pretty good music in here, so.
So people don't really. So we're starting here. We're starting again here because we had a little musical interlude there. So people don't really appreciate the idea that you have to go out and work your ass off and learn the trade.
The people that have come around to me, it seems like 90% of the time they want some kind of quick route. Maybe the people that don't come to me are just doing figuring it out on themselves because,
yeah,
they're hard workers. But yeah, I don't know. And I also tell these kids, you know, oftentimes younger people, like, study all these, the history of photography, and look at all these people, and, you know, don't think you're inventing the wheel. You know, figure out where you fit into this thing. If you really love photography, and this is like my music friends, they do it, the ones that I really like. Figure out what you're doing and who all these people are. Like, study the jazz guys, study the rock and roll guys, study the country guys. Like, learn that shit, copy it, and then sooner or later you start doing your own thing. But you got to learn that first. So I'll talk to these young kids and they don't know who anybody is. They've got no sense of the history, which means they don't really have a sense of all those processes. Some people think this is fuddy-duddy. It's like, oh man, that's just a bunch of heavy stuff. I don't need to know. But it's like,
so what?
You think you're just some genius that's going to start whacking off digital quickie photos that, you know, do you want to be taken serious or not?
Yeah, it's
like, learn this stuff.
Yeah, that surprised me when you speak to climbing filmmakers, outdoor filmmakers. They've never seen any films. They've never seen... Stanley Kubrick, they've got no experience.
So I can't understand these people that, you know, you sense that they want to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, we see them at these festivals. They, you know, you expect that they want to win a prize. Well, winning a prize is respect. How do you get respect? But, you know, there is a chain of command to all this.
Yeah, I'm also read The Guide to the Perplexed by Werner Herzog or some of these books because they're about someone... making a life as a director, but starting from nothing. You know, I think Werner Herzog, he went to a production company and they just laughed at him because he was so young, and he just decided in that moment, I'll just do it all myself, and that's what he did for the rest of his life. And that's a really valuable lesson if you're but people are like, what kind of drone should I get? You know,
Jesus,
it's like,
Christ, if I had never seen another drone shot. You know, I was on the jury in 1 month, two different juries at Bilbao and then Banff, and how many drone shots did I see? Drone shots and the time-lapse stars at night. you know, the stars
and
moving across the sky.
Sliders, like...
Every single movie.
Yeah.
And I swore, it's like, whenever I make a film, I will not use a drone, and I will not do a time-lapse star shot.
I think a lot of films suffer from a lack of the basic idea to tell a story. You know, tell a story that's interesting. And, they're almost like an advert. Maybe where people brought up on this diet of adverts.
And I love visuals. I love, whatever effects. Or, you know, I love interesting visuals. But it seems like people are just concerned with that.
Yeah.
Not the story. They learned how to do this trick. Lots of tricks.
Yeah.
But, you know, you got to keep people engaged. And especially nowadays, the audience has seen all the tricks.
Yeah, yeah.
Over and over. So that's not going to keep their attention. So,
yeah.
A story is still the best way to do it.
Yeah. Someone told me they had a project to film Expedition to Everest. And in the contract, the climbers said, we don't want to, you can't film us when we come down from the summit because we'll be so tired. You know, that was probably going to be the best part of the film, but they were so worried how they might look. And you definitely have this thing where people are, they're embedded. The film team are embedded with the climbers, like they're embedded with the Marines going into Basra or something. They're the friends of the climbers. They don't want to make the climbers seem like selfish assholes or. You know, so I think that's the trick is to make a film where you just set out to destroy this person and really get to the grips of their, you know, all their failings and their, you know, and that creates like a real film. But if you go there, it's like a Red Bull advert. We don't want our athlete to look like his.
One of my favorite memories ever in my whole life of mountaineering imagery. Or story or whatever was when I was a little kid before I think I'd even climbed in the local crags or anything and just had my imagination of what climbing must be like. And I'm pretty sure it's the West Ridge of Everest, Hot Tom Hornbein.
Yeah.
It's before I had the book, but I had seen it. I think it was in National Geographic, an excerpt from his book. But, you know, I must have been 9 years old or something. And it's the point where they'd been up there for a month or two, you know, trying to get up this thing. Been up at base camp and up in the ice and the snow. And they were finally coming back down after it all played out. And they got to the first patch of grass. And the Barry Blanchard with the National Geographic, I don't know who took the picture. But, you know, way up high, wherever the... 18,000 feet, 16,000 feet, wherever the first grass is. And I think one of the guys, it might be Hornbein's, on his hands and knees. And then they're joking around, but they're also thankful. Finally, this green sunlight hitting this little patch of emerald green, and they just were putting their face in it. And I thought, that turned me on as much as any of the other actual climbing stuff. The thought that, you know, people would go out like the moon.
Yeah, yeah, come back to Earth. Yeah.
And then you're coming back into this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It still stands out as a great little piece of...
Yeah, I think it's the same with a lot of people, isn't it? It's not the, you know, the marketing departments of the world. They have no time for subtlety or nuance. It's like...
Everything's a 5'15 dino. And
or base jumping for... I think maybe that's why base jumping...
There's no poetry in that stuff. I mean, I'm
no time for poetry.
And blown away and inspired by the sheer athleticism of all these things. But, you know, I got into... Nobody cares why I got into climbing because I'm not a notable climber. But I did get into it for the poetry and the kind of beauty of all that stuff, too.
Yeah.
Not just the movement.
Are you like a romantic... Do you have a romantic view of... Everything.
To a fault, probably, yeah. Extreme.
Yeah.
Chronic. Bad, probably.
So you're like, there's that whole kind of Jack Kerouac kind of adventurous, you know.
Yeah, I'm guilty.
Yeah, yeah. I guess.
And that's changed in various ways through the years. But, I think it's great on one hand. It's definitely informed the way I do pictures and the way I guess right now, or even live life, but you know it's got its drawbacks too.
Because America, it's all about the landscape, isn't it? It's a really Like, I've never, you know, I've never been anywhere like that. Like, there's something about America, nothing to do with Americans and Americana and all that kind of, but like, the landscape is like really, like, incredible. I don't really, like, you know, you go around Africa, you see, you know, you see these interesting places, but there's something about America, I don't know why it is, but if you travel from Las Vegas, you go from Zion, you can drive from Zion all the way to Yosemite, you'll never drive through that kind of landscape like that, through the Sierras. And
it's amazing. I sometimes wonder how we would think about it if we had never heard the American myth, because there's so much of that when you're in America.
Yeah, yeah.
And all my friends from Europe or Asia, you know, their dream is to do a road trip. The road trip, the American road trip.
Yeah.
So that's all built up in the, you know, somehow this story. And of course, America was settled, well, by the white man anyway, in the East, and, you know, go west, young man.
Yeah.
And, you know, the pioneers moving and sort of the development of society, and time went on. Then you get to California, and California is really, I always think of it as sort of the cliff. It's the end.
Yeah.
It's the end of it all. Once you cross the Pacific,
you're back to the past.
You're back to the beginning.
It's, yeah,
the oldest human beings have been found right over there.
Yeah.
And all that craziness is there, but I think that landscape gets built up in the story. You know, you're going from this sort of mellow East Coast, forested, friendly, society-friendly kind of place, and you start going out, and like, if you're a person who's wanting to test your mettle, get away from home, have an adventure, the landscape goes right with you.
It starts
to get desert and big mountains and crazy extremes.
It's like, right,
and it's perfect for that caraway. It's just made for all that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. You see, it's almost, you become like radicalized. You know, like, you went, like, a Californian is so different from anywhere, you know, meet some from Minnesota or, you know, anywhere, like New England, you know, and they're much more kind of European.
Yeah.
But, you know, the more you get towards the sea, the more crazy everyone, you know, everyone is. But there's that amazing thing, I think you said the other day how, you know, you have, like, you know, your Microsoft and Hollywood and Silicon Valley and these things which are, like, revolutionary forces on the entire human civilization in this one place. And it is tied to the landscape, the environment, the kind of people. So there's this, I've been thinking a lot, because here where we are, we're in Poland, so you have this, the whole kind of Holocaust. It's like Poland is almost like a Disney-esque Holocaust kind of thing. There's a lot of people here. It's kind of strange, really. It's interesting speaking to Poles about the Jews and the Holocaust and everything else. But the Jews are a manifestation of being oppressed. You know, the Jews are successful and they have to work. They had to work traditionally, you know, 200% more than everybody else to get anywhere, to get anything. And I wonder if that's the same. The people who could leave New England, travel all the way to California.
Yeah, I think there's that cowboy pioneer spirit.
Out there. Like, you know, someone said, you know, the grapes of wrath. Like the family who, I can't remember, who actually make it to California, like a lot of those end up working in the aerospace industry, became really successful.
It's an amazing story of these Okies that went out there and the relatively quick turnaround of how things got developed out there. I'll plug my friend Rebecca Solnit's book, River of Shadows, or Rivers and Shadows. Just Google Rivers Shadows, Rebecca Solnit. But she writes about... she writes about this eloquently, brilliantly, about this thing that happened out west with movies and cinematography and computers.
Yeah.
Highly recommend this book.
Yeah, yeah.
But something happened out there, and it is, I don't know what to say, you know. We're looking for something when we go out there, and these kind of pioneers found it. And, you know, Doug Robinson, the climber.
Yeah.
His father is kind of one of the original reasons. He was assigned to, you know, NASA, before it was even called NASA, was in Langley, Virginia, or somewhere near D.C. You know, and they wanted to jumpstart this aerospace, you know, NASA thing, and he went out and scouted California, and he said, this is where we need to do it.
Right. That's interesting.
And that, in turn, formed Silicon Valley.
Yeah. And I guess you had, like, Boeing, and you have all these, you know, change. And Howard Hughes, like the, you know, because then the Hughes...
Skateboarding, I mean, it all came from California.
Yeah. Music, the... Except that whole kind of New York, you know, New York kind of thing. Then you have the, you know, San Francisco, like LA kind of thing. It's really, yeah, really. But then I guess there's so many, you know, for every one person who makes it, you know, heading west, there's like 1,000 people.
Dead in the desert or burning on the streets. There's also a lot of, I think the homeless people in Los Angeles in particular are the craziest on earth. A New York homeless person is never as crazy as these acid-baked, just sun-blasted, glazed-eyed lunatics you run into on the West Coast.
Yeah.
There where Scientology and cults and veganism and isms have grown up. And God, the people on the street are scary, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
New York, I find reasonable.
Yeah, yeah.
The darkest criminal in New York, you can sort of talk to, you know, just because he's still a human.
Yeah, yeah. I know. What's the place where all the vampires live? Above Monterey. What's that city there? You got Monterey, you get to San Francisco. There's one in the middle where all, you know, that film, The Lost Boys.
What's that? I don't know.
Anyway, I can't remember what it's called. But you go there and it, you know, you can really see why you would imagine the place was full of vampires, because there's so many odd characters. I think the so you left and you went, decided to do your own thing. Where did you go?
Well, it's weird that I didn't go to New York, because that was my I really had some being in this little town. Only child, kind of dreaming in my bedroom all day, in my head all the time. I just had all these pictures of where I wanted to go, and it was definitely away from home and away from North Carolina. But New York City, really, I was kind of obsessed with it. I knew every street. I studied maps. When I was 9 years old, I knew where everything was in New York. And when I finally did get there, I did. I found myself around perfectly. You go uptown, it's like I was talking, like, you know, take a left at 42nd Street. But as it turned out, I did have a couple friends in LA, so I ended up moving there first, and it just seemed to be a little more, for whatever reason, manageable.
Yeah. And what did you do for money?
I was broke. But photography, you know, I'd quit school.
Yeah.
And, photo assisted mostly.
Yeah.
But when I first got out there, I needed money, and I did these. This is Hollywood before it got cleaned up. You know, it's pretty scummy.
Yeah.
And I got this job at the Preview House Theater of Hollywood, and it was up above. What movie theater is that downtown? One of the great movie palaces. But you know, Hollywood Boulevard was definitely turning scummy. It was beautiful paradise, but at night it was just full of all kinds of criminal activity. And upstairs in one of these big offices, this was like Glengarry Glen Ross or something.
Yeah.
Worse. There's a whole bank of telephones and all these tables. And, you know, I'd go up there with these junkies and weirdos and, you know, and we would have a whole list of phone numbers. And we're trying to get people to come to see these Hollywood movie premieres. Or not premieres, but previews to get audience.
All right.
You know.
And then you would ask. Then they would have to fill in forms.
And you would, you know, tell them that, you know, we would give you parking and all this stuff. But you basically, this is of course before iPhones. This is rotary or push button phones. But 000001, you know, just down 023, every phone number, and they'd give everybody a different stack of phone numbers, and one after another for 4 hours. And this was a job that I did at night. We were calling people at 11 o'clock at night. Of course, we got hung up on. Hi, this is Jim Harrington from the Preview House Theater in Hollywood. And I'm like, I used to know this spiel for a long time. But I'd get out of there at about midnight. And I was making, who knows what kind of money I was making. It was shit. I didn't have a car, and I would walk home, and it was kind of like Times Square, I guess, just streetwalkers everywhere, prostitutes everywhere. I'm just getting grabbed in the balls by this big tranny. Sometimes you want to party. I'm like, party? An interesting concept. What an interesting, a party, really? But gradually I kind of, I got a job at in the dark room. One of my favorite photographers was Gary Winogrand, a street photographer in New York City in the 60s. He was hanging around Lee Friedlander. Well, I don't know about hanging around, but he was a contemporary of Lee Friedlander and Deanne Arbus. And I met a guy who introduced me to his darkroom guy that printed his books and printed his shows. Winogrand had just died. So I got a job in his darkroom. That was kind of the first real photography job of any consequence. Not really me shooting, but I was working under this guy who had printed for Jim Marshall, who's a big music photographer, but Winogrand was the important one. And kind of a intense Boston guy, had a small dark room down on La Brea Avenue. And I made coffee, swept the front, and started developing film for him, working in the dark room. And Winogrand had this way of working where he would shoot hundreds and hundreds of rolls of film per year and would not process them because he didn't want to see them immediately. He wanted to have a very objective view.
Oh, wow.
So he would wait till the end of the year and develop all his film. So when he saw it, he wouldn't know if that was a good day. Was he feeling good? It was like looking at a stranger's film. He could be very objective. However, he died of too much drink. And when he died, there was hundreds of rolls of film left over in his fridge. So one of my first responsibilities was going over there to his widow's house, who was still grieving, I guess. One would assume she was. Who knows? He was a big drinker. There was a mountain of Smirnoff bottles.
Really?
Looked like a Peruvian ice caked in the L.A. sunlight, glistening Smirnoff. And me and Tom would go over there and get more film and bring it, and I would process it. So it was kind of crazy. One of my early heroes, I was developing his last rolls of film.
Wow.
It was cool. So
when you were on the phone, when you were ringing all these people up, in any way was that leading on to, in later life, you're contacting these people, these random people, they don't know who you are. You're trying to sell them this idea that you're going to come and take
them. It's all based in desperation of some sort. But yeah, everything's
there's lonely. There's lonely old people. You're ringing up saying, "Hi, I'm Jim Harrington. I'd love to come and
take a
everything's
an ask, and everything's a sell, right?
Yeah.
I mean, don't you feel like that in life?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What do you want? You want a job? You want a girlfriend? You want a date? You want a fuck? You want a coffee? You want a... I mean, as soon as you get out of bed in the morning, there's an ask.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or some kind of striving towards whatever it is. Mine, you know, was probably built on some original desperation of, you know, I was broke.
Yeah.
I was, you know, I quit school and I moved out there. I didn't have any money. So, and also, you know, I was a small town boy. I didn't come from, you know,
some kind of
crazy Harvard educated art world or anything. I was a North Carolina hillbilly who, you know, even though I was looking at all these kind of high-minded art books and had good taste in movies, I think, and, you know, I still didn't know anything about it. I hadn't really interacted with it. So I felt like I had to fake a lot of it.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know even what the reality was or
what
my place was. So it was all a pretend until I figured out how to do it. Fake it till you make it.
And is it still like that?
I think once you set that in motion, your life can. It takes a lot of untraining to be natural and
to be,
or even accept the fact that you've actually, you know, learned. You've learned, son. Relax. Yeah. You're fine now. You know, it's it's sort of like you're a criminal for life in a weird way.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to untrain yourself.
I guess that kind of, because I think...
because you're doing the same thing. We're both, you know, we're putting out books.
Yeah. But it's a kind of criminal mentality. Like, if you ever listen to someone, like I, as for some reason, I've met quite a lot of people who are like drug addicts or whatever, or, you know, homeless people, or whatever. And they tell, they're the most amazing storytellers. Like, they really understood the how you could weaponize pity, you know, like, oh, this terrible thing happened to me. And, you know, they'll tell this story. And, you know, we live in a world where people are like, oh, that's so terrible. Here's some, you know, and they'll just go along on this pile of smack or something, you know. And the criminals are the same. They'll always tell you this story about how they ended up, you know, murdering someone, but it wasn't their fault. You know, they just, you know, the prisons are full of all these people who are victims, you know. And you listen to them, and they're really good at it. There's like loads of people on YouTube, look at all these criminals.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, at once charming,
yeah,
selling you something, a great salesman, and at once this amazing denial of it's somebody, kind of narcissism built in all that.
Yeah,
I mean, that's why I love New York, kind of, you know, homeless and or criminals on the street. They're much more entertaining. You know, they can charm the money out of your pocket without having to rob you. But also they
have nothing to lose, so can often be amazingly honest. They often have insights into us normal people that we can't see, because, you know, some people know they'll never ever escape this situation they're in. There's no way in the world, you know.
And as a result, there's a whole part of the game they don't have to play.
Yeah, yeah.
Or
yeah.
Want to play or need to play.
Yeah.
And so the honesty that comes from that.
They have, instead of having fuck you money, they have like fuck you poverty or something, you know. It's not like if they work really hard, they're going to...
Fuck you poverty.
Yeah.
Man, that's what I want to aspire to.
But I guess it's that...
Probably close.
It's a kind of another cliche. Where we talk, like, cliches are... I'm a big fan of cliches because they're always 75% true. But this, like, stoical view of life is that we need to imagine less rather than more. Like, oh, if only I had an iPhone 11, my life would be a lot better. But you should be thinking, you know, if only I had a blanket that didn't smell of piss... You know, so it's but those, you know, I'd be very careful not to look at people who have nothing. Like, oh, these people in this village, you know, they have nothing. They're always so happy, you know. But do one thing wrong, they'll chop your head off. You know, it's very wrong to romanticize poverty. But there is a point where you just have enough where you don't have to give you don't have to care, you know. And as long
it's funny you mentioned well, I don't know. I remember reading Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah.
Whenever I read that, junior high school, or whenever they gave it to us. And what's the one where he's in prison?
Gulag Archipelago, or one of those.
I guess it's the one where he's getting these little scraps of black bread.
Yeah.
And keeping them in his pocket. This is really interesting to talk about because I never talk about this, but it even reminds me of being in the mountains and, you know, camping or whatever, suffering cold, you know, whatever that is in the mountains. But I did kind of romanticize or think about this sort of him suffering in that cold prison.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was just his ability as an artist and a writer to bring some humanity into that suffering. But
yeah.
I don't know what I can say about that. When he's talking about just getting these little bits of bread and how amazing that was.
Yeah.
And there would have to be a little scam with the prison guard and just getting these little squares of black moldy bread. But it almost seemed kind of cool to me.
I think
a lot of my friends in school were like, oh my God, can you imagine this horrible thing? But I found, you know, him... wherever you're at, like on a mountain or where, finding the routine.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, kind of...
When you go into a mountain hut, you know, it's in the winter in the mountains and you eventually get to this hut on the other side of a mountain, you kind of push open the door and you get in there and there's like half a bag of noodles or something, and it's the most incredible... There's a gas canister with a bit of gas in it. It's the most amazing thing. Like we were on the in a hut on Mount Kenya, and we found this. You know, the American Army, they have these like meal ready to eat, these rations, and now, you know, this full of all this processed crap that lasts for 1,000 years. And in this hut, we found this one thing of cheese from American US Army ration. Like it was like a sachet of cheese. Just squeeze this cheese out. It's probably the most toxic thing, you know. Could we set fire to it and blow up a bridge or something? We found this cheese and we found
Agent
this
orange with milk.
Yeah, and this tiny bit of pasta that was left in a bag. You know, it'd probably be on this. You know, and we cooked this pasta up and we squeezed this cheese on it, and it tasted absolutely amazing. You know, and but then you could be in a, you know, a most amazing restaurant. It didn't taste as good as that cheese.
My tartare is just a bit in the complaining. Yeah. But yeah, finding that.
It's working backwards, yeah, instead of working forwards. Like both of us, if anyone looked at our lives correctly, they would judge that we're basically, you know, like hard up, like hustlers, who are always like only one job we don't get away from absolute poverty. You know, there's a, but we've lived that way for such a long time that we can, we know we can survive. You know, like. There's always, you know, we have all these skills that we know we have. Although I'm being paid to be here and you're not being paid to be here, so maybe you need to develop some of those skills. But the money is never the important part. And it's very easy to say that, make people assume that's because we have lots of money. But we always have enough money to not worry it so much. Where people who are always all they ever think about is the money, generally are very poor, I think. Whether they've got like £1 million in the bank or...
Well, it's funny you say there's skill sets, because I don't really think about it and you probably don't think about it. And like you say, we've been living like this for so long, we're used to it. But then you talk to some people, you know, some friends, and you realize, and they say things like, you know, God, how do you do it? And you're just thinking, I don't really think what they mean. But then a couple days later, I'll think about how they asked me. It's like... Some people really don't know how to live on the edge.
Yeah. Someone the other day said to me...
For extended time.
Someone, a really famous climber, said to me the other day, I have so much money, I no longer have to look into my bank account. And I was thinking, I never look in my bank account because I'm so afraid. What am right. I find?
I never look for always, a different reason.
There's always much less than I assumed was in there. And you just... Yeah, like, because again, we're both very similar. Like, this kind of, if you kind of grow up in, you know, I always make this joke that when we were kids, we were given clothes because we were poor. And then later on, like Patagonia give you clothes because you do stupid shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but you always know you can always go back to that. You're like your poverty isn't so bad. Like, you're not going to starve to death. There's, you know, there is a base you can start working in B&Q, or you can get, you know, some really shit job.
Well, I was trying to get to some point a minute ago about this. I'll try again. So I also had these dreams when I was a kid. For years, I had these dreams, and it was before I'd been to bigger mountain ranges, but I kind of made up some kind of extended Appalachian mountains, much higher, much steeper, some kind of a rut. Very high, gray, kind of always very dim, twilight. And I'm way, way up on this thing. And I've got this little ledge. And it's very forbidding, swirling dark clouds, steep drops everywhere. But there's this sort of, you know...
this sanctuary.
Little, teeny thing. But yeah. But it's mine, and I found it. And I'm up above, and, you know, I can look down. I don't know if it's like some gargoyle or something, but extremely comforting in all its darkness. And I had this obsessed dream all through my childhood, into my teens. But then it's also like, you know, I kind of like when the power goes out. It's like I can pull out the camp stove.
Yeah.
I sort of like when things get to survival mode.
Yeah. But you know, you get these communities... You know, you live in this like highly modern civilized society, and then one day this big dump of snow comes and the power goes out, and suddenly everyone comes out and they start helping each other and helping the old people, and they have this like 24 hours where they suddenly revert instantly back to some how we used to live maybe only 100 years ago, maybe less than that, and they absolutely love it. And then the snow melts and the power comes on and they go straight back into...
Selfish, get out of my yard.
Yeah, the government will do everything, and where all of a sudden it's like they take ownership. Like, I think I'm a...
Well, it's nice to see that. It's a nice to see that we do have some humanity left.
Yeah, oh yeah. And, it's always in
and
there.
And it doesn't have to be practice every day.
Someone told me that he was in a, an officer in the army, and he was in Afghanistan. He said he had all these young guys, you know, 19-year-old guys, who probably spent all their childhood playing computer games, not very fit, you know, just like a modern British, you know, teenager. He said these people were like so heroic, so brave, so they could just switch into this default setting of a human being, of this animal, which could be noble and... You know, and but then they could switch back again. You go back to a base and they'd be playing on their Xbox, you know, and like 24 hours before they were dragging, you know, some guy, they were carrying some guy. And I always thought that was, there's a way we can often look at people and say, oh, young people, they're all, you know, this or that. And where I think there is a default setting for most people, you know, we are all cowardly and afraid and have anxiety. But that's because we're privileged to have anxiety, we're privileged to commit suicide, we're privileged to worry. But when you really are when the snow is like 5 foot high and there's no power, there's no time for all that, isn't it? It's like, right, let's start breaking out the furniture and making a fire. Or
I think most people, as much as everybody kind of likes Netflix and they like getting a frappuccino and all the, you know, I think modern society does kind of stress out everybody, young and old alike, even the youngest. And when things get down to that simplicity, I think it's kind of a breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
Just to turn things off for a bit and see what's important. What's important? Eating tonight, not having snow fall on my face, like something over my head, some heat and some food. And everybody can relate to that. And I think, you know, when the power goes off, it's a bit of a relief to say, I don't care what movie I'm watching tonight because there are no movies tonight. You know.
Yeah, the ability to do nothing is...
When people get it, like when that stuff shuts down, I think it's kind of a relief even to youngins.
I guess we live in a time where there's so much choice, so many multiple choice world. You're like, where our great grandparents, there was no choice. They did exactly what their grandparents did. You know, I had a relation as a coal miner before the Second World War. And there was no, unless you went and joined the Navy or the Merchant Navy, that's what you were. You were a coal miner. And you had this really brutal life, but everybody else was the same. You know, and it was just you weren't going to be. You didn't want to be like a fashion designer and move to Milan. You know, you just didn't want to die until the age of 40.
Well, I've always kind of slightly envied the village idiot who's never been a mile past his house.
Yeah,
hasn't read a book, doesn't know what's going on in the world. Truly doesn't.
You need to move to Ireland.
Well, there's no going back, and I love my complicated, weird mind and life, but imagine, like you were saying, like not being stressed about, you know, what college, what career, what movie tonight, what meal, what hobby, what, you know, all these choices, endless choice. It's a lot to think about.
I know people.
And imagine just, well, I'm going to go milk a cow. I mean, can you even imagine what goes through a mind that doesn't dream?
They probably have a kind of wisdom.
What purity of existence.
But they probably have a kind of wisdom that we lack. In that, like, when living in Galway, in like extended family, there's people who've never been to Dublin, let alone never been to another country. And there was a really famous thing where they interviewed this Irish farmer, and they said to him, what would you, if you won a million euros in the lottery, what would you do with it? And he thought for a minute and he said, I'd buy a new gate. which is amazing.
I used to joke about, you know, when people start saying, so Jim, what would you do if you won $1 million? I said, well, I definitely get the best darning done on my socks. You know, I've got some holes in the side. I get every single one of them fixed. But me and my dad loves to drive through the North Carolina mountains. When I was a kid, we just kind of aimless driving. We always did these exploratory things. And it's, you know, especially in the 70s and stuff, still quite hillbilly and remote. And we kind of got lost, and we're down in this little area, and we passed this old man, obviously he had lived there his whole life, very remote. Just kind of, and we were asking where this little town was that we just missed, which was only like 6 or 8 miles away, and he had never heard of it. I don't know.
And that sounds like most Americans.
And we thought, well, no, this was really uncanny, because it's like, well, maybe we're... our accent, even though we're just 2 hours away living, maybe our accent, maybe it didn't, Pensacola, I think was the name of the town, not Florida, but this, no, I can't say I ever heard of it. He's like 80 years old, and we still talk to this 25, 30 years later. Was he fucking with us, or was he just really that into his holler?
He
didn't know what was on the other side of it.
I once remember getting a lift with an American guy, hitchhiking. Never a good idea. And the guy was like, where are you from? I'm like, I'm from England. He goes, England? England? What language do you speak? I was like, English. He went, English? What, like we do? And I think, but I think Americans get a really unfair... they get like a really unfair press. And... but often it's to do with language. People actually understand what you're saying. They think you're Australian, or they just don't. Like, you ask for some butter, and they go, what? You go, have you got any butter? And they go, what? Have you got any, like, butter for, like, a potato? Bad butter, butter. And you're like, butter. And you start doing the thing. Oh, you mean butter.
Butter.
You know, and it's, so it's, again, I think, you know, like, most miscommunication is at the heart of almost all human interactions, that we're not actually very good at communicating with each other. I don't know why that is. You know, we're very good at sending the signal. We're not very good at receiving the signal. So maybe, you know, when you were on that phone, you know, and then you, or when you're having to deal with the widow to get so my son here, I got him this job one day a week in a publisher. Sounds like one of these, like, you know, rich assholes who gets his son. But anyway, so I have a publisher who publishes my books, and I was like, can you give my son a job? Because he needs to, you know, see the real world, see how it works. So he worked there for a few months, and I was like, so, like, Ewan, like, what have you learned about the publishing business? And he's like, he said, it's just people on the phone, just people talking on the phone. And that's actually a good insight. Publishing is not about books. It's about talking to people and trying to, you know, get the books from the author, and then getting the author to write the book, and then getting the printer to print the book, and getting the designer to...
Absolutely. Just, publishing, you know, is not writing.
Yeah, and then telling the people to buy the book. And
what
then,
you do is a completely different thing.
Yeah, but even writing is about communicating. It's all about... So if you, like, look at Shakespeare, all those stories about miscommunication, you know, you think she's dead, she's not dead, you know, you kill yourself, she, you know. It's... and I think, you know, you said it's a very good thing to understand early on in life. You might not realize you understand it, but being able to communicate with people. So I often say to young climbers or people, you're like, I've had like 3 businesses, but one of the most important things I learned to try and make money is tell people what you want, which is the simplest thing you could ever think of. But people don't. They go around the houses. You tell people what you want. You tell people how much you want, how much, you know, this is what I want. This, you know, you either give it to me or don't give it to me. But if you can't give it to me, what can I give you instead? Or what? So you just have this really simple thing. And busy people, you're like, I want to be sponsored by you. I want £20,000 a year. And they say, well, you know, that's the first thing you say to them. You don't say, I'd like to be sponsored. And no, no, no. You have this big, long, you know, people are busy. Like, I want £20,000 and you can sponsor me. I'll wear your clothes. I'll do this for it. What do you think? And they go, well, we can give you £10,000. But we want you to do this as well. We want you to do these extra things. And you're like, oh, well, I can do half those extra things, but I'll want it. And you just, but you, within the space of like 60 seconds, you can, the deal is done. But instead you have these, like, people then...
I find that nobody wants to negotiate anymore. Negotiation is like off the table. People...
Oh, really?
Yeah, they kind of fly. It seems to be younger people. It's like, you know, in this photography world, which is very weird now.
Yeah.
Budgets have shrunken.
Yeah, yeah.
And they, you know, people are hiring people that aren't so great because they'll do it for free.
Yeah.
But negotiation, you know, and just those kind of things where let's talk out a deal. People are trying to throw out this one version, but they don't really know how it works, you know.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
In my case, I've been around for a while, some decades in the biz, and you'll be talking to someone in their 20s who's somehow managing a deal of whatever it is you're working on. And they say, here's what we need, and here's the pay, and it's always ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I say, well, you know, that's a little out of the question. What about this? And then they just kind of scatter sometimes.
Yeah. So you have no power.
Never counter offering.
Yeah.
Just this kind of cruel. They scatter.
Yeah, yeah. I guess you're in the wrong business, maybe.
No, I think they are.
But they know themselves.
But
they know themselves. Like if they agree to this deal you want, then they'll be the one who's removed by the guy above who equally is, I can just replace this guy. He didn't replace his photographer with a cheaper photographer, therefore I'll just get rid of that guy. And the next guy...
I'm like, if you want me, you got to pay for me. If you want just anything or anybody,
yeah,
there's plenty that will do it for free.
But they're like these gatekeepers. You know, like production companies or the BBC or the, you know, these people who traditionally had all the power. You know, people are desperate to get this TV series together, and they're coming up with this absolute shite. You know, it starts with a great idea. You know, let's take this woman who's just learnt to walk again, and she's going to cross the Gobi Desert, and it's like like a 1 hour documentary. You know, just one other person. What? And then it's like, well, could you do it with a footballer? You know, should he go across with a footballer? You know, because we need someone who's just a celebrity, because she's just a woman who just learned to walk and wants to cross the Gobi Desert. We need a footballer. It's like, oh yeah, that'd be good. And could we do it as like a 6-part series? And could she walk across, you know, some other places as well? And then it's like, well, that woman is a problem. Could it be a footballer and Angelina Jolie? And it just becomes this absolute shit fest of shitness. And it's completely
away from the original story.
And it goes along for like a year, and they're getting this little bit.
And that's how all these things get adapted.
And then at the end,
someone comes in with this intimate, Netflix. Great story about a human story, and there's just exactly what you say, these little changes, and then you suddenly get a 3-year Netflix series that has nothing to do with the original
idea.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that poor filmmaker and person just get forgotten and left.
Yeah.
Aside.
But I think... Because
it's not commercial.
It's because the people who are the gatekeepers are all... You know, there's always someone above them. They're always afraid. I think we live in a world where it's run by kind of parking attendant kind of people.
But it's amazing how that stuff will dictate what's going on, because...
The culture.
Those gatekeepers actually change over really quick now.
Yeah.
In the old days, like these photo editors... For some of the great magazines, they would hold reign for...
Till they'd retired, I guess.
Sometimes decades, and some people might think that's kind of bad, the power people being in control, but in a lot of ways it wasn't. It was these really brilliant people that had long relationships with artists and photographers.
Yeah.
And they knew how to negotiate. They knew how to... They were very visionary, and they got the right people for the right job, and they really cared about what they were doing.
Yeah.
There were repercussions.
Yeah.
If things weren't done right, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, just there, you know. Everyone cared a lot more, and now you have these people. I can't keep them updated quick enough in my phone book. Now she's the art director. Oh, wait. Carol Jones. I thought it was Carol Smith. So that Carol's gone, now there's a new one. And, you know, how can they care when they're only there a year?
Yeah, yeah.
And
punished for any mistake.
And their budgets have shrunk, so, you know, being really good, you know, good enough is sort of the new deal now.
Yeah. Is it like a revolution against competency in a way, like...
Like a deliberate
revolution? Like it's almost... So this idea of mastery is if someone is... It's almost... it's not democratic to have this person who is has been, you know, in this job for this old white guy who's been running this magazine.
Mastery does seem old-fashioned these days.
Yeah, it's like chivalry is another. You know, I think these things
are very old-fashioned and just too heavy for us to deal with.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like sometimes some of my photography. The craft I take in the printing and the thing is a bit too Baroque. Or because, you know, people really, I mean, these ad campaigns are now kind of based on the look of the sort of Instagram.
How would it fit? Look on the phone, yeah.
Yeah, very casual. You know, these snapshots, while, you know, they're kind of nice and attractive to look at, but they're meant to live for about an hour or two and get some likes, and then they go down the feed.
Yeah.
And that look is so prevalent, and but it's casual. I think people like this kind of, they like the short lifespan and the immediacy of this, of the sort of Instagram picture, and that has kind of infiltrated into fashion spreads and the look of...
Is it not the celebration of like mediocrity though? Like most people...
Well, that's why I was asking, do you mean deliberate? Is it a celebration of it? I don't know if it's...
If you're Picasso, you know, like, why do art galleries only... Why are they only filled with pictures by the great masters? You know, that's not... That's a bit... They're all privileged with talent. So
well,
why
that
should...
gets back to those kids I was talking about. They're like, oh, I got to work.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't. Maybe I am the old fart who's talking about learn how to do it well. And they're finding out, you know, I don't have to. I think there's people out there working a lot more than me that, well, you know, some shit you just can't understand.
Yeah,
things
yeah.
change. And maybe mastery is an old-fashioned thing.
Well, I think I told you that I started having...
Things move fast. Mastery takes time.
Yeah.
Daddy-o.
What was that thing? It was like an advertising agency saying... I don't like the word new anymore. I want you to find me something better.
Yeah.
But I had this... I started having it with it like a one-tweet debate with someone who was basically talking about all voices matter. And, you know, like, there's all these, like, you know, hidden voices and this, all this kind of stuff. And I said the idea of mastery is, like, really important, you know. Like, otherwise you're just going to allow all this mediocrity kind of creep in there. And her response was, mastery is a gendered term.
Really?
And I just said, I'm out. Like, I'm not gonna have a conversation with you because you are insane. And I really worry.
They really said that.
Yeah, and it's, you can't tell what's a joke anymore. What's like a parody of someone, and what is, you know, most of it isn't a parody. But that person's an academic who I'm having this debate with in a university, and she is, you know, an academic of, you know, she should be the best person to be teaching people, you know, ideas. But if you're fundamentally seeing the world, that the word mastery is a problem, let alone what mastery really means. And so I think that, I think in the past, I think people, you lived in like a world without bullshit. You know, if you were good at something, after the Second World War, the idea of privilege and everything else was broken down. You know, people came back from the war and they had the GI Bill, all these things. And people, you know, people who would never have gone anywhere, a system was in place where people could rise up because they were really good at things. And I feel like we're going the opposite way again.
I mean, if you don't look up to mastery, then, well, I see this with a lot of people too nowadays, where maybe it's connected to this empowerment thing.
Yeah.
Everyone's empowered.
Like an Oprah Winfrey kind of.
But it's like, if everyone's so empowered, does that mean it seems a little old-fashioned and quaint to have heroes?
Yeah.
I mean, I had nothing but heroes across the spectrum
of
music, writing, art, photography, climbing. Nothing but people I looked up to and wanted to somehow get close to, you know. I mean, as far as learn from and whatever technique, And
but does that take too much
work? I don't feel like, I don't hear that as much.
Does that take too much work, though?
I don't know if it takes too much work. Well, and that, my immediate thought is, yes, it takes too much work. But then as I think about it, I think it's even more darker than that. It's putting someone else above you. You know, everything is such a me thing now.
How dare
starting
can
with
you
MySpace and Facebook. Everybody has an 8x10 now. Everybody has their resume. That's what a profile is.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether it's LinkedIn, Facebook, dating, everything's a...
Yeah.
A resume. Here's my headshot.
Yeah.
It's me. Oh, what am I interested in too? Let me tell you. I have appreciate a the literature of... everybody's gotten good at this thing.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
I mean, 20 years ago...
These are my pronouns.
Everyone's just used to talking about themselves. And they do more and more of that, they're talking less and less about other things. Or
it's all about the brand.
Or heroes, yeah.
Yeah.
I find that, you know, and so if you're not really having heroes, then, yeah, what does mastery mean?
And is it dangerous to have heroes? Like, if I said my hero, like, one of my heroes...
I don't think it is as much as people think it is. There is a bit of...
if you have, like, Malcolm X, if you have, like, Martin Luther King as one of your heroes on your Instagram thing, then you find out that there was some kind of rape allegations or something. Suddenly you have to remove that because this guy is...
Well,
you know,
life is a... You know, Woody Allen, whatever, there's all these alleged and real things... Life is dirty and people are afraid of the messiness of life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm one of those people that can separate the art from... I don't know. Like, what's the limit? Is this like a child raping mass murderer Stanley Kubrick? Where does it go?
I won't watch their film. He had a good side as well.
But he also made some good movies.
You know, a good example of this is if you look at the first Rocky film... You know, I love some pop culture. The first Rocky film is this guy who was a complete, you know, he's over the hill. He's everything is going badly. He's like a enforcer, and somehow he gets this point where I think he loses anyway at the end, doesn't he, Rocky? I don't think he actually wins against Apollo Creed. Maybe in the first one, I can't remember. But it's a real. By the time whatever success he gets, you know, he's like this guy. But if you compare it to like Creed, which is, you know, is that like the sixth or seventh film? You know, you have like Apollo Creed's son, who is almost not really done any real, it's really not really suffered. So you end up becoming like, to come to the same position, you know, there's no real mastery. It's almost like, you know, a superhero where suddenly they just appear. They have no real background story. They're the strongest superhero in the world, and they can do all. Well, most superheroes, they have to go through the parents who were killed. You know, look at Superman and, you know, Spider-Man and all these people. They always have this hero's journey where there's a lot of darkness, and you know, they fought and they overcome, and then they become this superhero and they have to fight against, you know, all this kind of stuff. Where now it's like, oh, those superheroes. You know, like Superman, he's a bit privileged because he was a white guy. From Krypton.
Yeah, there's all kinds of reasons. I mean, in calling people heroes, maybe that's the wrong word, but, you know,
because
you need to have, you know what they say about goals. Like, if you don't have a goal, then how do you know when you got there?
Yeah.
And I think that's the same with inspiring people. You know, how do you lift yourself up to be the climber you want to be, or the photographer, or the writer, or the musician? You know, if you haven't held Chuck Berry or Django Reinhardt up to this high degree,
you'd be masters.
I think it's everything, actually, having these people. How do you know? They're standard bearers.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's the most important thing in life is to have these people in society, as humans on planet, to have achievers that we look at and appreciate and strive to.
Yeah, yeah. I think if you look at some Muhammad Ali... And Malcolm X, like two...
I mean, that's the religion. People, you know, that worked hard and did great things. That's the full flower embodiment of our human existence.
Self-improvement and... Yeah.
With all the dirty, weird mistakes we make and all that. But I think that's the religion.
Maybe we're going back to a time where unless your mother had sex with a god, you know, you're not... You're never going to get anywhere.
Right.
Yeah. Like, not everyone
I lost
can,
out on that one.
Not everyone can be Achilles, you know, you need to...
just mortals in there.
Yeah, we're just mortals. But yeah, I wonder... But eventually, I think eventually... It must always go back where people start. What we really need, someone who's really competent to do, you know, like planes are built by competent people, you know, like generally, you know, you don't want people that just like, you know, how you'd run a magazine, like running like a
well, that's what
Boeing or something.
With Boeing right now, right?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Whistleblower guy came out. There had been a restructuring of, and they were starting, the guys at Boeing were just saying, well, you know, this is going to take a lot of paperwork and this is mucking up our thing. Just, we're not going to talk about this. This is what's going on with
all
them.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. It's starting to become...
Yeah. I think it's like the same in politics, the same in, you know... There's this thing about having the safe pair of hands. You know, like if you're having to do with television and stuff, it's never about getting the most talented person, because talented people are generally quite hard to control. They're... You know, they're unreliable in a way. They kind of do their own thing because they're not held back by all the mediocre people around them who are trying to, you know, they see them as just being a sheep. Just get this person into there, and you know, they're running around, they're jumping, they're scaring everybody. You know, all the other sheep. You know, like just kill that one.
So is it like a chess game? We need the pawns that.
Yeah. Everyone has a. I guess it's a. Everyone has a place, I guess. Everyone has a, to, you know, and...
That destroys everything I just said. Maybe that's the ultimate truth.
But it's only, I think it's only 4% of jobs that exist are creative. And most people don't want to have a creative job. Most people want to have a job where it's completely mundane and repetitive and robotic. But unfortunately, all those people's jobs are being replaced by robots and machines.
They don't call it robotic for anything.
You know, and I think maybe there's a reaction of that is people are increasingly angry at people who have creative jobs. So in a way, like the two of us, we're living in a, you know, like we're living in a time where we have skills which can't easily be replaced by an algorithm or what, you know, like a machine.
Well, a lot of people, yeah, you're right. A lot of people are wanting to become in this, you know, creatives.
Because it's a
and
safe...
And now they can, because digital photography has made things easier and all these digital programs make filmmaking possible. But not everybody's cut out for it.
And I think increasingly increasingly people go into it, but then they realize you can't make any money. They give the impression that they're making a living, but they're not making enough of a living. Because they assume that you make a lot of money doing it, maybe. So they can't, their lifestyle isn't able to...
Oh,
no, thank you.
I'm sorry, love.
Sorry, no.
No, sorry,
I don't speak. I don't speak either. Yeah. No, we don't have any money. We are poor. We are poor writers. We are... No, sorry. So there's a good example of communication, you know. So maybe she came to speak to the wrong people. But so maybe there's like a revolution against those people who, like, if everybody else is going to lose a job, like it's something, like the number one job for a man is driving a car or driving a truck. So with driverless cars, all those jobs are going to disappear. And a lot of the white-collar jobs are going to disappear as well, because computers can do the same thing. So the people who, the upper classes are going to be people who can use skills which can't be easily be replaced by a computer or some other, you know, so maybe that's why, maybe they're just pulling us down. So here, you know, like if you replace the word Jew, with 1%, if you look at anything the Nazis said or anyone else, it's completely relevant to what someone who rails against the 1%, just replace the two words, it's exactly the same. So maybe, but basically the Jews were oppressed because they were so competent. They could run complex organizations, factories, government departments, and they became, people hated them because they were so competent. And you'll see the same, with like the
Lebanese. It's also just easy to blame the minority when your majority is having any kind of trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
And Trump's taking that rule book. Find some minorities to blame.
Yeah, yeah.
And get everybody rallied around that. It's easy. It works every time. As
yeah.
I said.
You see, I think it's kind of hardwired into people to be. I think people, their default setting is some kind of bitterness, envy. You know, like maybe a lot of religion, organized religion, is trying to combat that. Those things which are very divisive. Like, you know, if you go through life bitter and envious and hating your next door neighbor, you're like, you know, what do you call it? Coveting someone's ass. You know, like religion is trying to take away all those parts of...
Well, that's the one thing I like about what I do is that I don't really feel subject to the whims of the economy.
Yeah.
So I can't be pulled into...
Or manipulated.
Burning and hanging and gassing certain people because, my economy is kind of based on me.
Yeah.
It doesn't... You know, I've done great when the economy sucks.
Yeah.
I've done terrible when the economy has been great. So yeah, I don't ever seem... I would never vote on the economy.
Yeah.
Because it's seldom affected me that I can tell.
Yeah.
I've got this mini economy of my own that's...
But you're also free. You're also someone who can... Like most people, the poorer you are, the less mobile you are. You know, because of your family structures, you can't just... I think my great-granddad was he worked on the docks in the East End of London, and there was obviously some kind of, probably in the 1920s, financial, you know, the Great Depression. Like, he moved to Yorkshire, to Hull, which is another city. They probably had something else was going on. They had the fishing industry. So the fishing... People still eat fish, even when there's a depression. But they maybe not be buying as many things from other countries. You know, there's not much trade. So that ability to be mobile, like I tried to teach my kids that the idea of staying living in Sheffield or Leeds or somewhere is a complete mistake. Like populations were always, the most successful people have always been willing to move somewhere else and not be static in one place. And I think there's a lot of places in the UK anyway, same in America, like Detroit and places, they have no real reason to exist anymore. You could just remove them and move everyone, tell everyone to move somewhere else. And all those people would be better for it. You would destroy their communities and everything else, but it would be better for their children, their grandchildren, to not be in that place anymore because it has no reason. It's like living in a fishing village where
it's
the sea...
It's true. And it doesn't matter why, you know, just look at it. The fact is it is not working anymore.
Yeah.
And, it, you know...
You're on a downward...
Some people have that allegiance to home.
The steel
but if
factory
you really
will come
care,
back.
Yeah, you're right. If you really care about your family, you should care about your current one, not your ancestors.
Yeah, yeah.
Staying in this sacred
home. Stay in this decrepit, this falling apart house, you know. But maybe being a creative person is this, like, hunter-gatherer. You know, when we were hunter-gatherers, like when you hang out with hunter-gatherers, they have very little. You know, they have, you go with a...
it's alpine style.
It is, yeah. Like these guys we met in Kenya, we were teaching these guys about climbing. It's like a Kenyan tribe, kind of what it's called now. Is it the Kikuyu? Anyway, this tribe, and they have a... The guys have a blanket. They're incredibly vain people. They have this. The guys have this blanket. They'll maybe have some, like, a kilt type thing. They'll have a belt and they'll have a little mirror on the belt because they like to check themselves out. They'll have a mobile phone. They'll have a cup, and they use this cup to make blood tea, which is milk and blood mixed together. And they'll have a knife, and they might some people might have like an AK-47, but they might only have like one bullet or a few bullets, and that's just to shoot. It's not to shoot animals, it's to shoot other people who are going to try and steal their goats or whatever. But they live a really, really simple life, and they are genuinely incredibly happy, joyous people, and they know everything about the landscape. They know the stories and the myths and everything else. And so that we were there because they had this idea that, you know, The Western idea is that these guys, they need to go to Nairobi and learn to do, you know, learn engineering, or they need to get rid of all these old-fashioned things and become civilized. And what they do, they end up having these qualifications. They go and work in the government, or they work in something. They lose they become fat, depressed, you know, unhappy, they become corrupted by everything. And it's like, maybe these guys have got the right idea, you know.
Well, you say hunter-gatherers, and I started thinking about alpine style, fast and light.
Yeah.
But I just started thinking about vaudeville people who were traveling with one trunk.
Yeah, yeah.
From city to city, Iowa City, and, you know, and... And you said learning the local stories, you know, kind of doing that.
Yeah.
And these people.
Hustlers, basically.
You know, it is kind of hustling, but, you know, suddenly you get a radio gig. Oh, I got a morning radio show in wherever, Milwaukee. So stay there for a while and then hit the road again. It's tenuous, I guess, compared to the American ideal. But then if you compare it to these tribesmen you just talked about, it's exactly the same thing.
You know, this idea that when we had the agricultural revolution about 10,000 years ago, that instead of us domesticating wheat, that humans were domesticated by wheat. So, you know, which is a really great way of thinking of it. You know, we ended up stopping hunter-gatherers and we stayed in one place and all we did was grow wheat all over the world. You know, everywhere we went, we just grew wheat and that's all we did. We were like enslaved by this wheat. And if the wheat failed, we all starved. And then we had to protect the wheat because other people who lost their wheat would come and try and get our wheat. So we had to build walls and have armies. And we had to have people who would organize us all together. We had to have kings and rulers. And the world is still on that, still organized in that way. So you know, this idea that conservative people...
The hunter-gatherers, you know, I mean, it can be lean. It can be dangerous.
Like Elvis, you know, Elvis was a hunter-gatherer and Jerry Lee Lewis and... Justin Bieber, you know, they're...
But then Elvis wasn't. Once he got that rich, he became kind of enslaved to the house and to the...
Yeah, yeah.
Well, to Colonel Tom, that's a whole other story, but, you know, he became very stationary.
But you were saying about Jerry Lee Lewis, how he became this hugely famous person, but then lost everything and had to start again. So hunter-gatherer is the same, you know, like... He would be facing famine and starvation, and he had to move on to somewhere else and start.
And I interviewed his wife, who was his 13-year-old cousin that he married. I interviewed her a few years ago, and she was telling me that story. She had never been interviewed on video ever.
Oh, really?
Which is astounding to me. She's such a massive part of rock and roll history. Massive. She'd never been interviewed ever on video.
Wow.
That was the first time. And she was talking about, to the listeners who may not know, Jerry Lee Lewis was around the time of Elvis Presley and had this meteoric rise within a year and a half, was the biggest thing in the world. Two big hits on the radio. Went to London. They found out that he had with him his 13-year-old cousin, who was his wife, who he had married. And they jettisoned him out of the UK. And as a result, his worldwide stardom dropped down to the bottom once again, making $20 a night again. So his wife, Myra, ex-wife, she goes, a lot of people forget. They forget about me in this part of the story after that London incident. They sort of... just forget. They know me about this. But we were married 10 more years after that. And she said, you know, those were the years where he could not get arrested. Just no money. But he said those were the happiest years of our life and his. And he was happiest when he was making no money. He loved playing. Jerry Lee was so just such a maniac about music. If he was just playing in these honky-tonks for no money, that's what he enjoyed the best. And things were pretty sane. And she goes, the only time things really got nuts and crazy every time was when the money started coming. And in 1968, suddenly he was becoming a country star and he started getting millions again in hits. And that's when the big drugs and the insanity came back and they got divorced. Anyway.
Oh, wow. So I think we'll... We could see you all day talking. I think I have to fly home soon. So.
Oh, you have a plane to catch.
Yeah, but it's been great talking to you. Not, but we didn't talk about climbing very much. But you know.
Oh yeah. What do you want to know?
Climbing's boring. We'll save that for our next is another installment.
We're doing El Cap, right?
Oh yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to climb El Cap. So right. Yeah, maybe we should make a film about climbing El Cap. Anyway, well, how can we hustle? How can we hustle climbing
something
El Cap?
Else somebody wants to see me on a run.
Yeah. Anyway, well, I shall switch off this recorder. We'll go and find that woman and give her a slotty or something. So anyway, goodbye. All right. What time is it?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.